being.
Going to be seated, everybody. In State versus Wilcox.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Donnan on behalf of the appellant, Hugh Wilcox. I'll hope to reserve 3 minutes. Mr. Wilcox asks this court to reverse the exceptional sentence in his case and remand for a standard range sentence, in particular because of the lack of a finding on behalf of the on the part of the jury and the lack of evidence to establish the more egregious nature of this his particular conduct in this circumstance, which we argue is essential for imposing an exceptional sentence under the amendments to the SRA following the Blakely decision. The legislature was quite clear in codifying the exceptional sentence criteria that it sought to take into account the common law standards, not to expand them nor to contract them. And the case law from this division was quite clear in moving up to that point, Flake in particular, that the substantial injuries aggravator included two particular elements. That is, the injury itself had to be substantially more than necessary to otherwise satisfy the crime, but also that there was an underlying conduct element, and that both of those factors had to be present in order to satisfy. Something on the conduct. The court specifically refers to conduct in particular that has to occur in these particular.
It seems to me that the briefing seems to take the position that the wrongdoer had to intend more serious harm.
I think that intent is a natural manifestation of what would occur in an ordinary assault circumstance. This case is unique in that it doesn't involve necessarily an intent, but rather a reckless infliction of the harm in these cases, in this particular circumstance. There was no intent to commit any other act. There was no separate act other than whatever it is that was the individual act that resulted in the substantial injury here. And when one compares the facts in this case to all of the other cases upon which the more substantial than typical aggravator has been imposed, they consistently involve a variety of different acts by the individual in question. Whether it's the Wilson case, which took up that standard in 1999, and specifically describes not only the defendant's stipulation in part of to acts in the part of his guilty plea, but then describes the additional acts in the context and surrounding the indecent liberties and the assault itself, and how those particular acts engaged in by the defendant then exacerbated the harm that resulted from the assault and therefore justified it in that particular circumstance. And that, I think, really illustrates what's unique about this particular case and why the conduct element is missing here, but it doesn't necessarily manifest itself in cases like Stubbs, for example, or Pappas, where the conduct or the egregious.
The legislature wrote what it wrote, and it didn't, in that particular statute, it did not mention conduct whatsoever. It only referenced the injuries. Why do we even, I don't think there's any ambiguity there. Why are we even worrying about interpreting? Why don't we just the legislature wrote it? That's what they, and they meant what they said.
I believe the legislature meant what it said, but it was quite clear that it intended to incorporate the common law standards that were utilized in these particular cases, and it reminds me very much of the same way in which we approach assault. We say assault is the particular crime, but
Your argument is, even though there's no ambiguity in the statute, that we should interpret it anyway in contradiction to its own terms.
No, I believe that when you interpret the word substantial injuries, that case law tells us that that incorporates two different standards, both the injury itself and the conduct that must flow from it. And I think that's the only way to give effect to the legislature's specific determination that it intended to incorporate those common law elements, that it did not intend to essentially lower the standard by allowing exceptional sentences.
Aren't you really telling us that we look somewhere else where in the statute says it intends to incorporate and not change the common law, and that because it didn't use both conduct and injuries here, we look to those other words and add the word conduct? Because if I just handed you a piece of paper and wrote the word substantial injury on it, there's no way you would tell me that the ordinary meaning of those two words includes conduct. You need to have something else that tells you that you want to add words, some more information.
And I believe the legislative intent.
So you're telling us that even though the word substantial injury on its face isn't ambiguous, if we look to the intent of the legislature, they obviously meant something other than the ordinary meaning of those words, that it's shorthand for something more.
I think that's exactly correct, that it's a legal term of art, that that legal term of art incorporates the two standards that were identified in Flake and carried on or repeated at least in Wilson, and that those require both some aggravated form of conduct itself as well as the aggravated form of injuries that are the essence of it, and that the court was quite clear in splitting those out in earlier cases. Tunnel, for example, which involved some particularly aggravated forms of rape involving instruments and vaginal penetration and a variety of injuries that are outlined in a long course of conduct. But the conduct is never in dispute there, so we've ultimately come to use a shorthand. The only one that, case in the ones that have cited that involves a similarly reckless conduct is Warren, but it involves multiple gunshots. Again, multiple acts of conduct causing injuries far beyond those that are otherwise required in order to satisfy the statutory requirements. And this, then, is that sort of unique case in which there is no significant conduct beyond whatever that initial act was that that must have caused the injury in question here. So while tragic and extraordinary as the injuries are in this particular circumstance, the criminal law is very much grounded in the intent, the acts of the defendant, and in punishing those particular acts, and in the absence of an aggravated act, some additional conduct on the part of the defendant, we believe it falls outside the scope of the statute. We would ask the court to reverse the sentence then.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. Kristen Relier, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, representing the state of Washington. This court should affirm Mr. Wilcox's conviction and sentence for two reasons. First, because the trial court properly instructed the jury on the aggravating factor, and second, because Mr. Wilcox's vagueness challenge fails, which I'm happy to address that in a moment. But turning to the issue that the court has had the most questions about, here, Mr. Wilcox waived his challenge to the aggravating circumstance by failing to propose the conduct language that he now says should have been included. It's clear that in the trial court, Mr. Wilcox was focused solely on amending the jury instruction to include the words that he intended to cause great bodily harm. And that's clear both from the trial memorandum at CP 19-22 that he submitted, as well as his comments in RP 669 and 734-35 to the trial court, that what should be added to that aggravating circumstance instruction was that he intended to cause great bodily harm. Conduct was never mentioned. In the reply brief, Mr. Wilcox is seemingly trying to get around waiver by framing the issue here as one involving the sufficiency of the evidence. But you only reach the sufficiency of the evidence if you agree with Mr. Wilcox that the aggravating circumstance here at issue required the state to prove that the defendant's conduct was more egregious than typical. And when we look at the common law, it's clear that the aggravating factor at issue here was solely concerned with the seriousness of the victim's injuries. We have the 2010 Supreme Court decision, Stubbs, that recognized that the aggravating circumstance or factor that became codified as a circumstance in 3Y was the, quote, serious injury aggravating factor.
So you're disagreeing with counsel's characterization of what the law was before the SRA?
Yes, absolutely. And in the Stubbs decision, it's significant that the court takes great pains to discuss multiple decisions at common law applying the serious injury aggravating factor. In none of those decisions, or in its discussion of those decisions, is there any reference to the defendant's conduct. Additionally, in subsequent Washington Supreme Court cases, specifically Pappas and Duncalf, in those cases, the court was concerned about the seriousness of the victim's injuries. There was never any discussion about the defendant's conduct that caused the harm. When you look at RCW 994A535-3Y, and you look just at the plain language of the statute, as Judge Spearman was referencing, it makes no mention of the defendant or his conduct. It simply says that an exceptional sentence may be imposed if, quote, the victim's injuries substantially exceed the level of bodily harm necessary to satisfy the elements of the offense. The best I can tell is that Mr. Wilcox is relying on a paragraph in Wilson, which I quoted in my brief and highlighted the language in that paragraph that is specifically focused on the seriousness of a victim's injury and that aggravating factor, as well as a decision from this court, Flake, that quotes another decision from Division II, I believe, the Warren Court, which had some language that you could possibly say was linking the conduct producing the harm and the harm produced. But on page 29 and footnote 10 of my brief, and I'll spare you, if you go through the sort of the legal archaeology of Warren's citing three cases, and if you go through those three specific cases, which I believe are Armstrong, Butler, and Tunnel, you'll see that none of them stand for the proposition that this aggravating factor at common law, the seriousness of a victim's injuries, that that also encompassed a defendant's conduct. This court,
the paragraph in Wilson's a misleading archaeological artifact?
Not quite. Wilson is separate. I was referencing Warren. So it's...
Well, you quote the paragraph from Wilson in your brief.
Yes, I do. And then I also in the footnote explain why you can't depend on... Wilson makes a reference to Flake and quotes Flake and then says citations admitted. If you go back to Flake, you see that Flake is really quoting Warren, another case. And if you go to Warren, then you look at the three cases that...
And they don't support...
Exactly. Decision. Yes. Yes. This court should affirm Mr. Wilcox's sentence because the jury was properly instructed on the aggravating factor. I'm happy to address Mr. Wilcox's vagueness challenge if the court has any questions. And if the court doesn't, then I'm also happy to sit down. I realize I'm at the end of the calendar.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
First, with regard to waiver, it's the state's ultimate burden here to establish the facts necessary to support the aggravating circumstance. And what there is not here is anything, to the extent that you can agree with us, that defines conduct here that was more egregious than typical. And to the extent that we believe that that is a requirement, then the prosecution of the aggravated exceptional sentence in this state in this circumstance is inappropriate. Mr. Wilcox was quite specific in his pretrial motions at Clerk's Papers 21 and 22, specifically identifying the aggravated nature of the conduct and quoting again the language out of Flake and Wilson, which identifies the two elements that must ultimately be proven. So clearly the issue is not waived. He's entitled to only be serving this if the evidence was sufficient. If we turn to cases like Stubbs, ultimately we don't know what to do with their application here because the Supreme Court finds that the aggravator doesn't apply in the assault in the first degree circumstance. Similarly, if we unearth the archaeology, we look at we get to Warren. It makes a clear statement of the rule. That rule is then reiterated up through the current day.
Do you agree with counsel that the three cases cited in Warren don't stand for the proposition for which Warren cites them?
No, I don't. I do not agree with that. Armstrong, if I can recall correctly, determines that there is no conduct outside what was required by the statute. So it doesn't stand for the proposition. It doesn't establish that there was anything sufficient to support an exceptional circumstance because the injuries themselves were subsumed with whatever the statutory definition was. The second case is escaping me, but I believe the same is true for that one. The third case is then Tunnel, which I described in my opening remarks as incorporating an enormous amount of very specific acts engaged in by the defendant in that particular circumstance and then directly relating them to the aggravated injuries suffered by the girl in question. And in that circumstance identifies both additional conduct, additional acts in which the defendant engages in beyond that necessary to establish the crime of conviction, and then specifically relates that conduct to the aggravated injuries that the individual suffered. And that is the essence.
Could be wrong, but wasn't it a multiple acts aggravator, though? Wasn't it a different aggravator in Tunnel?
There were that context was specifically within the discussion, I believe, of the injuries that she suffered and why they particularly occurred. The court in Tunnel used several different aggravators, including the injury one, and then there may have been other acts one, but there was a variety. Because there was an indecent liberties allegation as well as the assault allegation, it covered several of those. But I think it illustrates exactly the standard that's ultimately articulated both in Warren and Flake and carried on in Wilson, that there must be both conduct, and then that conduct that must be aggravated and lead to the aggravated injury. We would ask the court to so find and reverse the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I hope you're not too fatigued by your morning, Mr. McCurdy, and we're in recess.
All right.
Oh, you too. Take care. You could ask them to put in a little exercise.